So hello and welcome back to the Voice of Florida Architecture, where we share the news and happenings around the state from all 13 components. I'm Rhonda Hammond, AIA, your AIA Florida 2024 president, and I'm so excited to be here. Today, we continue our series of conversations with our vice presidents. We've launched this series to introduce each vice president to the membership and beyond, to allow each to share their vision for the profession through their committee and to share what is currently going on around the state. Today, we have the privilege to speak with our Vice President of Resiliency, Mr. Julian Norman Webb, AIA. Welcome, Julian, and thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you for this opportunity. This is a wonderful opportunity to talk about the Resiliency Committee and all the wonderful people who make up that committee.
Great. So you're a board member, you're a leader at the local component, architect, and local advocate. But before we get into resiliency, can you share your unique journey to architecture? And then from the UK to the US, you've got an extra leg of a unique journey there.
So it's a unique journey and it's a long journey. And I would kind of summarize it as saying that my architectural journey was kind of one of osmosis. I don't have the story of playing with Legos and Erector sets as a child. I did that, but I was more interested in soccer and rugby. Those were my passions, and then road cycling. So with hindsight, what I see looking back is I kind of learned through osmosis. And I was very lucky as a child that my parents traveled widely, and they always took their kids with them. And they always traveled over land or by sea. We never flew.
And oh, wow.
We went as far as Asia Minor, North Africa, and almost all the European countries, both west and east of the Iron Curtain in those days. And it just kind of opened my eyes, and I absorbed so many different cultures and geographies. And that, coupled with the fact that I grew up in houses that the youngest was built in 1600, and one of my parents' ways of making money was to restore old houses, take them back to what they were, and live in them, and then flip them, as we would say here. And I also grew up in a city which was only 20,000 people, but it was the capital of that county. So it had a civic importance. It was a Roman town when it was first designed. So it's the only town in England with a grid to it. It doesn't have the kind of street pattern that all the other towns in England do. And I was always interested in history. So I learned about all these different historical facts, and I learned them through buildings. I experienced architecture as a kid, because when you walk around a city like that, you walk into a church, there's a Roman mosaic that's been excavated under it. You see that they found a Roman palace in the landscape about 4 miles out of town while I was a kid. And the farmer just found it by accident. And then it was excavated and became an enormous tourist attraction. And so I learned all about the impact of architecture in the built environment just by living it. And it was a wonderful way to learn. And then I actually, as I wasn't inherently knowingly interested in architecture, my career choices were actually either a dairy farmer, a meteorologist, or a British bobby. And it was only when, in those travels with my parents, we went to Finland and I saw the work of Alvar Aalto, and I was like, this is what I need to be doing. That just hit a chord for whatever reason. I went to college in Bath, which I would argue is the most beautiful town in England. And it's kind of a little bit the same story. You can kind of learn by osmosis without going to a lecture, but I did go to lectures. And I love traveling, and I wanted to continue traveling while I was at college and had no money. So how could I travel with no money? And to do that, I did my internships in Paris, and I ended up going to school in Strasbourg in France and Brussels in Belgium as well. And through invited scholarships and earning money as an intern, I kind of just about kind of got by. And it was also the time of the presidential projects in Paris. So that was what pulled me there in the first place because it was the hub of architectural excitement in Europe at the time. And I actually had the amazing opportunity of being an intern on the French National Library. And that is what has set the bar for me ever since. And the problem is that when the bar is set that high, you never reach it. But it's a great goal to carry around with you.
What an incredible story. Swinging back around to the resiliency, the committee, both in breadth and impact, is extensive, not just at the state level, but we serve as a role model for the rest of the country. The state of Florida serves as bellwether for addressing the climatic issues of our times, whether it's sea level rise, storm surge, flooding, more frequent and intensive storm events. You know, we've had several hurricanes already this year. And I think new to Florida is, to the extent that we've experienced here, is tornadoes. But we have a unique opportunity to lead the nation in understanding the issues and being on the forefront of developing resolutions for them. Tell us about the Resilience Committee and why you think its work is so important.
Let me start off, first of all, just by thanking Lindsay Perez, who was very much the person who started the Resiliency Committee 5 years ago, and then Elizabeth Carmago, who was our second chair. And I think Lindsay spoke very powerfully when the committee was first established, and the necessity of the committee has not diminished since. If anything, we're seeing in our daily lives and with recent events how important it is. The AIA nationally defines resiliency as responding to climatic conditions and world social, economic, and physical conditions in a way that allows the built environment and people to prosper. That's paraphrasing, but that's essentially what it is. So resiliency is physical, it's social, and it's economic, and it's really safeguarding the health, safety, and welfare of the public, which includes our clients, includes our users, it includes all of us. And it's obviously become something that's at the forefront of many people's thoughts at the moment, because we can't just ignore the climatic changes that are happening around us. It's impossible to ignore the events that are occurring, whether it's here in Florida, whether it's the landslides in North Carolina, whether it's the earthquakes and wildfires in California. And it's also events that sometimes we don't think of as climatic events that we need to be resilient to, like extreme drought and overheating in our cities. Dallas in Texas is suffering many summers from large numbers of people not having houses adequate to meet the cooling needs that they have, let alone the question of literally paying for the air conditioning, just the fact that in the beginning, the urban fabric and their individual buildings don't meet the needs of those people living in a cool environment. In Europe, we've had heat waves where many people have died for similar reasons, because the building stock just couldn't give them a living conditions that were cool enough for them to physically survive. I mean, sometimes these resiliency questions come down to a matter of life and death, and sometimes they're just coming down to the general well-being of our population, which is also very important. The full definition of the AIA is that resilience is the ability of a system to anticipate, absorb, recover from, and adapt to adverse events. And you could also say that that's just a wise use of resources and what in the past we often did anyway. We didn't expect to build buildings that would suddenly fall down. We didn't expect to build buildings that didn't shelter their occupants correctly. And it's perhaps only more in recent times when the lifetime of a building has been thought of as more as the lifetime that you have to pay back your original loan for, and that there's this idea of a 25 or 50 year horizon to building stock. Before, people didn't think like that. And that's one of the big lessons, I think, of the vernacular. And we lost that. And I think we need to get that back again using the technologies that we have today. It, in many ways, is the most important thing that we can talk about. Because outside of health and the medical side of that, we are talking about the well-being of our populations day in, day out, and for years to come. And it's going to become a tougher task as time moves on, because whatever one's partisan position or independent position, you can't ignore the fact that these events are happening and they're happening more frequently. When I moved to Florida 20 years ago, I was told that hurricanes never hit the west coast of Florida. So if I was going to choose between the two coasts, go to the west coast. When I had my first hurricane on the west coast, which was Hurricane Charley, I looked with kind of awe at the fact that somewhere in the middle of the state that year, there was one place in Florida which received three hurricanes because all three of them crossed at that one point in central Florida. And everybody said what an aberration that was. It would never occur again. And then this year, Sarasota has been hit three times. And we were hit with Hurricane Debbie and had inland flooding, significant inland flooding, which ruined many people's homes and was as deep as 4 to 6 feet in many neighborhoods. And it hit both poorer neighborhoods and wealthier neighborhoods. I mean, it hit, didn't matter your income, didn't matter how large your house was. There were homes of all types flooded. Then we had the storm surge of the second hurricane, and that endangered the people on the coast. My own house, which is on stilts, became an island for the first time. And that's a rather surreal experience when you live it, because we stayed. And then the third hurricane of the year, the most recent, brought us the winds. So we had the inland flooding, we had the coastal flooding, and we had the wind damage. And that's all in 1 year. And although these are supposed to be one in 100 year events, one in 500 year events, we're seeing that actually they're a lot more regular than that. And that there's also a disconnect between some of the flood elevations that everybody builds to, because that's what we're told is the line of safety and the minimum that you need to build to. But we're seeing that those flood elevations, they don't meet the storm surge projections. So there's some large conversations to have about how we make our own state more resilient, let alone other states in the country too.
So what is the committee doing to educate the public and maybe alleviate some of the damage, or maybe some best building practices that help people build better? What is the committee doing?
So we have an educational outreach, and we have what one could term an advocacy outreach. So for the advocacy, with the help of all the members who come up to Legislative Day every year, we often opine on any bills that are being put forward that speak to resiliency measures. And we're also working with a task force that's led by Elizabeth Camargo, our president-elect, and which is composed probably about half of members of the Resiliency Committee. And the Resiliency Committee also plays a part in vetting and helping edit that work of the task force to look at enhancements to the Florida Building Code, which would enhance the resiliency of our built environment. And that is initially proposed as being voluntary, and it's something which could have a wide effect, because it will be up to each jurisdiction to look at what they think is appropriate for them. It also will serve as a resource to the public in general, as a book effectively of good practice. This is how best to, what measures would help you and reduce your likelihood of damage and economic hurt in the event of a storm, in the event of flooding, in the event of even extreme drought. What would be best for your project in order to enhance the security of its occupant? And on the educational side, under the previous chairs, there was a move for a series of one pages to be issued. So the first one pages were issued. There were six of those, and they each had a webinar that went with them. And those covered sea level rise, construction and materials resiliency, energy and water resources, equitable and affordable housing, and policy and advocacy. And that laid the foundation for the committee's work after that. So we have republished those webinars this year with continuing education credits for our membership, but they are available on our website for any of the member of the public or member who is interested. And we have a follow-up series of webinars which we'll be releasing next spring. And those are looking more at the economics of resiliency. So we have one that will be resilience in land use planning. We have resilience and professional risk and insurance, which will be probably of great interest to our members as this becomes more and more included in design. We have resilience in policy and advocacy, because advocacy is a never-ending battle. We have resilience gains through emerging technologies, so harnessing technologies that are coming through to help increase our resilience. And then we have an educational webinar, both for the public and our members, to speak to that work that the task force has been doing, putting together those enhancements to the Florida Building Code.
Nice. So, and those webinars that you mentioned, they're on our on-demand webinars?
They're on-demand on the AIA Florida website. And I am very fortunate. I have a committee with a very strong work ethic. And I give a shout out to all the members, because they have been invaluable. And it's a team effort.
Now, I know there's been some work to have some resiliency practices included in the next round of the building code as an appendices. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
Yes. So, can you tell us about that?
So we are looking to make presentations to the Florida Building Commission and post our thoughts with the Florida Building Commission in January of 2025. And then we will argue for those and argue passionately, because they are needed. And yes, they cover, at this point, they cover flooding, they cover water resources, and they cover moisture. So they're speaking very much to the quality of the envelope of buildings, the necessity for elevating buildings, and how you can treat various finishes and the structure to best withstand flooding. And then speaking to the use of water in our buildings. One of the questions we often get asked, and it's a necessity of making these applications to the Florida Building Commission, is, will this cost the user more money? Will it cost the public more money if these measures are put in place? And what is the cost benefit? And what we find with all of these issues is that there is some initial capital cost, as is frequently the case with any investment, but what it saves down the road is immeasurably greater. And there's many ways of looking at that. With water resources, the fact that as we draw more and more water out of our aquifers, the ingress of sea salt water into them is becoming greater and greater. And that's something that our state representatives in Tallahassee are very aware of. And there was actually a representative on the West Coast a couple of years back who was trying to get a bill through to help in the use of gray water. And that it is understood that we have an issue here in Florida, that we're either going to start building desalination plants, which are incredibly costly, or we need to work out a way of limiting our water use to meet the needs of a growing population, to meet the desire of everybody to have a green lawn, but at the same time, to have our own water and not be paying ridiculous fees to ship it in, which is what they have to do in some places. And on moisture control and so forth, you don't want a house with mold. Nobody wants a house with mold. And in our humid climate, it's the building envelope is the first defense.
Exactly. So if our listeners wanted to know when they could look at the appendices, when would that cycle? When's the next cycle? When would that be published?
So we will make our application at the beginning of 2025. And they are available that as soon as they've been reviewed by DBPR to then be posted for comment, I believe any member of the public can actually see that submission at that point. So that's approximately spring of 2025.
Nice. So that's just next spring. A lot of good work. So AIA National Strategic Plan discusses that in order for us to prepare for and shape the future of AIA and architecture, we must be bold in our actions. It claims that climate action is one of their main priorities in order for us to deliver real action to help mitigate climate change. Do you think the efforts around the state of Florida are meeting this call to action?
No, I don't think they are. And I think we have to be honest about that. I think there's an enormous problem that climate change is a partisan issue. And I think one of the things that we can try and assist with and facilitate is building a political consensus. Because to be honest, that consensus existed in Europe, although it's now fraying. And the lesson from Europe was the action that is needed is only achieved when there's political consensus, which effectively means that there's consensus within the public as well. That it doesn't mean there's no room for disagreement, but at least the consensus that we are facing increasing threats, whether they're hurricanes, earthquakes, extreme heat, basically every region of the states has something that could be improved in order to be more resilient. And we need that consensus so that those measures can start to be put in effect, that conversation can be had so that solutions can be devised, and that when architects design, when clients commission buildings, when the public appreciate buildings, when they review buildings, when they live and work in buildings, they know that that building was designed in as resilient a manner as possible for their well-being. I think it's very important, and it's great leadership on behalf of AIA National to have made this a priority for some years now. And they have their AIA 2030 commitments. And time is not on our sides. And within AIA Florida, we're all volunteers and everybody only has a certain bandwidth. But we have to work as a community, both architectural and public, to further this, because there's no disputing temperatures are rising, seawater salination is changing, seawater sea levels are rising, and this endangers people both in this country and around the world. And we have a role as leaders and a professional organization that helps lead to further that conversation as much as we can and bring it to people's attention that we all need to work at this, but we can't just put it off.
So what more can we do as members or architects to help gain that consensus from the public and from our legislators? What more can we do?
I think we just have to do more of what we do. So we have to advocate, we have to educate. We could probably put ourselves in front of the public that much more. I think it requires every architect to accept the importance of it, to step out. And when they talk to clients, bring it up in conversation. It shouldn't be something that we're looking for the client to say, I need you to design this project a bit more resiliently. We should be bringing it to the table from day one. We should be bringing it to community workshops. Whenever a project is discussed in the newspaper, if resiliency isn't mentioned, there's something missing. So a letter to the editor at that point, hold on a moment, there's something else to talk about here. And we should welcome that, because every constraint, every extra thing to think about in our buildings is actually an opportunity for greater innovation and design.
That was beautifully said. So Julian, your service to AIA is extensive. Tell me why you joined AIA. Why is it important?
I joined AIA because it is our architectural professional organization. It is the voice of our profession. And I understood the importance of a professional organization when I was a student. I was probably a fourth year student at that point. And so I was back in the UK. So obviously it wasn't the AIA there, but it was the Royal Institute of British Architects, which has a very strong relationship with the AIA. And the government of the time had introduced legislation which effectively would have meant that many architecture graduate students could not have afforded or been able to continue in their studies. That included me. And the Royal Institute of British Architects stepped up to the plate and they took the government to court and they won. And the government had to back down. We all continued our studies. And I was amazed because they beat the government and they stood up for students who were not members. That spoke to me about a profession that looks out for the forthcoming members of the profession. It's altruistic in that sense. And both metaphorically and literally, I have a debt to pay back. And it's an incredibly enjoyable and profitable way to pay it back by being a member of both the RIBA and the AIA, and just doing everything I can to further the cause of good design and the health, safety, and well-being of the public.
Congratulations, Julian, and thank you for your work on the Resiliency Committee and bringing all this information to the public. Thank you for your service to AIA Florida and the profession at large. Thank you for being here and talking with us today.
Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you.
So I hope our listeners enjoyed getting to know Julian as much as I have, and more importantly, becoming aware of the resiliency efforts the association champions around our state. I hope you've been inspired to get involved either at the local or state level. I welcome you back as we continue the conversations with our next vice president, and that will be our vice president of advocacy, Ms. Kelly Wazorek, AIA. So this is Rhonda Hammond, AIA, your 2024 AIA Florida president. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Voice of Florida Architecture.